Ernest Hemingway is the kind of author you either love or you hate. Whichever way you swing, he's definitely one of Michigan's literary celebrities. Growing up, he and his family spent summers in northern Michigan, near Petoskey, where he got up to things your typical teen would.
Skinny dipping in the lake and a little bit of extra freedom. It's dark and kids get to do what kids do after dark. And to me, that's just sort of the quintessential summer story.
Today, we're going to get up close with the Michigan landscapes and people that inspired Hemingway and his complicated legacy. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It wasn't just summers in northern Michigan. After being wounded in World War I, Ernest Hemingway came up north to recuperate. It's where he started his career as a fiction writer. It's where he had his first wedding. This week, Hemingway's getting some fresh attention with a new documentary by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick titled Hemingway. It premiered on PBS. So we thought we'd take a look at Hemingway and his Michigan roots. We're talking today with Christopher Strubel. He's president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Christopher, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's quite an honor.
Will you paint a picture for us of the area where Hemingway spent his summers?
Yeah, it's kind of just like it is now. We have these beautiful lakes that were carved out when the glaciers retreated 10,000 years ago, all this fresh water. And that was a boom for tourism in the 1890s. Lumbering had pretty much cleared the whole area, and they were looking for a way to revitalize the area, and tourism was the way. And they sent out a lot of promo stuff to Kansas City, Chicago, and St. Louis. And, of course, the Hemingways were one of those families that came from the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois, and found their way up here the first time in 1898. Dr. Clarence Hemingway and his wife, Grace, who was an opera singer who actually made a little bit more money than her husband did, they rode the lake that morning before they headed out, and they found a beautiful piece of land that was 375 feet long, beautiful sloping sandy beach. They had a child and then one on the way, and they wanted to make sure when they returned the next summer in 1899, Hemingway's first year up here, that they had a nice, safe beach. Dr. Clarence Hemingway was always concerned about the children drowning over the years, so he picked what I would consider probably the best beach on all of Walloon. They paid around $250 for 375 feet. If you were to compare that to today's average, it's about $14,000 a foot out there when you have parcels of 100 feet or more. So pretty good investment.
My gosh. Do folks who are in the area and who've lived there a long time, do you run into folks who remember Hemingway today?
We still have a few people that remember him or remembering him, you know. So these memories get a little convoluted a little bit. And then we had a local legend here, Irene Gordon. So in the time that I've lived in northern Michigan, Irene Gordon and Judge Ned Fenlon both lived to be collectively like 107 years old. So I've heard Ned Fenlon say that damn Hemingway stole my girlfriend from me. Must be something in the water up here as far as longevity.
Yeah. You have said that it's hard to find a Hemingway story that doesn't mention Michigan to some degree. Let's start with one that's actually titled Up in Michigan.
Yeah, great one.
Yeah, this was perhaps one of his more controversial, especially for its time.
That's saying something for Hemingway, right? One of his most controversial.
Right. Where did it take place?
It, you know, I was talking with the owners last night. It took place in Horton Bay at the Dilworth Cottage. And the Dilworth Cottage is comprised of Shangri-La and Pinehurst. And they served chicken dinners there. It was one of the more well-known resort communities in northern Michigan. And it was just three houses kind of combined there. The houses are still almost exactly as they were during Hemingway's time. Shangri-La is actually for rent. It's a summer rental. And it's one of those places where you can really experience Hemingway. It's one of those rare opportunities to sit there and read Hemingway in a house where Hemingway would have sat while he was thinking about writing Hemingway.
Hey, as a note, we're about to talk about one of Hemingway's stories that features sexual assault. If that's not for you, skip ahead. The story concerns Jim Gilmore, a blacksmith who comes to Horton's Bay, and Liz Coates, a young woman who's got a crush on him. At risk of giving away the plot of the story, there's a rape involved. Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's documentary on Hemingway features a reading from this scene, and I want to play some of it here.
"Don't, Jim," Liz said. Jim slid the hand further up. "You mustn't, Jim. You mustn't." Neither Jim nor Jim's big hand paid any attention to her.
It's a hard listen, but it gets at how shocking his writing was, and also points to some tension and power dynamics that we still talk about today. Do you have any idea of how folks in the area reacted to that story, or, you know, sort of the mores that were reflected in it?
Yes. I mean, for its time, Gertrude Stein said this story is unpublishable, even in that time. And of course, now with the cancel culture, who knows, you know, how that would be perceived. But, you know, we kind of try to take things in context of when it was written. But even at that time, it was still controversial. Jim and Liz were great family friends at the Hemingways. And it's interesting that Hemingway often wrote in several stories that it wasn't time to talk about these things because these people were still alive. But yet, up in Michigan, which was first written in 1921, the same year he would have stayed there for his wedding, he chose to use Jim and Liz by their first name. And in the original copy, he actually had the Dilworth's name written there, but he penciled that out and then changed it to Gilmore. So he really was, you know, incorporating them into the story. But that was part of his whole writing technique, was to write what you really know. And those early sketches that were so great were really things that he had experienced throughout his life. Now, of course, this scenario that happens in the story, again, without giving out the plot, it never took place. They were already a married, established couple by the time Hemingway met them, and he called them Uncle Jim and Aunt Liz. And when the story came out, there was quite a bit of controversy, not so much locally, but more internationally. And then, of course, this was the first of two big fallouts that happened in that summer with his parents. When his mother read the story, she couldn't believe that he had incorporated the names, and his sister Marceline felt the same way. You know, these were family friends, and to put them in that scenario was kind of a little bit, just maybe a little bit taboo.
Did Ernest Hemingway ever say why he did that?
You know, he didn't, and it kind of goes back to another story that involves Marge Bump. And we're talking with Marge, and that was another kind of controversial story about a breakup of a relationship that never happened. And Marge, her son's 91 years old. He's one of those people that still remembers meeting Hemingway. And Hemingway made a visit to their house in Florida in the 50s. And the, you know, the talk of the table that evening was, why did you use my real name? And he was always usually very particular about not really, you know, divulging who the actual person was. He would change names around a little bit, but yet here Marge Bump shows up as Marge Bump. As Sid remembers, Hemingway proceeded to drink all the gin in the house, and then they settled the score and everything was fine. But for some reason, in those two stories, he chose to use actual people, even though he was very sensitive about the fact that could be a little bit off limits. Hmm. And, but, you know, Jim and Liz, they kind of responded with a laugh. Here, he's a blacksmith, the real Jim, and the real Liz, and she serves chicken dinners at the Dilworth Cottage. And all of a sudden, here they are in the center of a international kind of controversy, a literary controversy, and they thought it was a little bit humorous, actually.
Jeez. There are other stories, Summer People from the Nick Adams series, and also Wedding Day. And Northern Michigan was the site of the actual wedding luncheon for Hemingway and his bride at the time, Hadley Richardson. Do you have a favorite Michigan-specific story in the canon?
Yeah, and you just mentioned it, and it's actually probably the first time that Nick Adams appears in fiction, and that's Summer People. That's one of my favorite stories. And it just really captures that freedom that he always talked about in Northern Michigan. You know, he came from a kind of a strict and regimented upbringing, so much in Oak Park to a certain extent. But when they came up here to Northern Michigan, it was kind of, you know, everything was open as far as skinny dipping in the lake and a little bit of extra freedom. It's dark and kids get to do what kids do after dark. And to me, that's just sort of the quintessential summer story. And if you were to kind of really analyze The Sun Also Rises and compare it to Summer People, you'll see so many similarities between those stories, in my opinion. And it was just the first one that really caught my attention. And it's probably one of my all-time favorite stories, right behind The Sun Also Rises, coincidentally. Yeah, so Summer People would be my favorite Nick Adams story and Michigan sketch. And when you walk down that beach and that stretch of road today, it's just like it was at that time.
Christopher Struble is president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Christopher, thanks so much for telling us a little bit more about these areas and what makes them special.
Well, thank you for having me. And again, this is my passion up here. And when it comes to Hemingway, I appreciate Cuba and Spain and Paris and all the places he's known to have spent so much time. But it was those 23 consecutive years that he spent here in Northern Michigan that I think really shaped not only his writing, but really had a major influence on his personal life also.
We need to take a short break. When we come back, what happened to Marjorie Bump? That real-life friend of Hemingway who became part of several of his stories. That's in just a minute.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
As we just heard, the Nick Adams stories are a collection featuring some of Ernest Hemingway's best-known tales, chronicling a young man's coming of age in Michigan. But this habit that Hemingway had of borrowing names for his characters from actual people he knew, whether or not he was telling truths about them, it got messy. Some students at West Bloomfield High School have been reading Ernest Hemingway, and they got access to letters this year from a woman who shares a name with one of the protagonists, Marjorie Bump. They've been transcribing the letters to get a better understanding of the people who inspired the writing. With us today to talk about the Marjorie Bump Letters Project are Jennifer Tynan and Yael Mizrahi. Jennifer is an English teacher and Literary Garden Club sponsor at West Bloomfield High. She's also the secretary of Michigan's Hemingway Society. Yael is a sophomore at West Bloomfield, an honors American Lit student, and one of Jennifer's students. Yael, Jennifer, it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer, for those who might not have caught up, who was Marjorie Bump in real life?
Marjorie Bump was a friend of Ernest Hemingway's who had met him when she was a young teenager in Petoskey. She was part of a gang of friends that Ernest Hemingway had up in Petoskey when he would go and live at Windermere during the summers there. They show up, they pop up throughout the Nick Adams stories. Sometimes he names them and then sometimes he renames them in fictional form.
I understand there was some dispute over whether or not Ernest Hemingway and Marjorie Bump ever had a thing going on. Do you have a perspective on that?
That's a complicated answer, because there's many answers to that question. Marge Bump's daughter, Georgiana Dickinson, wrote a book called Pip Pip to Hemingway, where Marge answers that question one way. Marge answers that question differently in the letters that we're working with, and I don't really know that I have the correct answer.
So let's just call that one a big gray area.
It is a big gray area, but I think that it's important that whatever it was, I don't think that it progressed very much past a high school romance. Let me just put it that way. I think it's important to note that it certainly wasn't anything salacious, and it certainly wasn't anything very intense.
Sure. And just to continue the thread, Marjorie Bump was a character who turned up in some of Hemingway's stories. Yael, you read the Nick Adams story, The Big Two-Hearted River, in addition to the Marge Bump stories, The End of Something and The Three-Day Blow. I was curious what you thought of them and what you thought of Marjorie as a character.
Well, it's quite obvious from reading the letters that Hemingway had a different viewpoint on Marjorie than she did of herself. It was interesting to be able to compare and contrast those. The stories were very interesting, and when you look deeper into them, there's many meanings beneath the surface. And it was very beneficial to be able to read those letters in addition to our Hemingway unit of The Three-Day Blow, The End of Something, and The Big Two-Hearted River.
For those who haven't read the stories, what kind of character is Marge Bump in the stories?
Well, she's only actually in the story as a character in The End of Something. She is seen as Hemingway's, as Miss Tynan said, either like a fling or a friendship. It's not very clear, but she's seen as a strong woman. She knows what she wants. She's smart. Sometimes that intimidates Nick Adams. As a reader, I really admired Marjorie in the stories.
Jennifer, the world of Hemingway's time was not always kind to women who were assertive, and for that matter, women who had a lot of agency over their romantic lives. Could you tell us a little bit about how readers reacted to Marjorie Bump when Hemingway published these stories, and how that may have colored what the way people reacted to the real life Marjorie Bump?
It was not so much readers as much as it was biographers that did the damage, and the small town of Petoskey that had tongues wagging, so to speak. In the story, Marjorie, as Yale mentioned, comes across as a very strong woman, and Nick is the one, he breaks up with her, and Nick is left crying on the blanket, and she rows off, you know, into the distance, needs no help, no tears shed, she's done. And it's really a powerful story where she walks away looking victorious. But afterwards, biographers said things about Marge without even knowing her, without ever contacting her, calling her this well-built waitress. They took the name Bump and made certain assumptions about her figure, about her standing in the town. They decried her as being low class. There's some literary criticism from Dr. Stoneback and Dr. Diker, who are preeminent Hemingway scholars, that rebut that vociferously. And that has, I think, helped to turn the tide against a long, long history of scholarship that paints Marjorie as some sort of vixen or some sort of, you know, tramp. I welcome that, and I welcome the opportunity to set the record straight on that, because a lot of that information is just plain incorrect. The other thing that I challenged my students about, it bothered Marjorie to no end that she could not remain anonymous once those stories were published, because her real name was used in the stories, and instantly everyone in Petoskey was wondering just what had gone on between the two of them. And so at that time period, they still needed supervision and chaperones and things like that. And so, you know, tongues were wagging, heads were turning, what had happened between the two of them that he felt the need to include her in these stories. So she moved. She got out of Petoskey and moved to Florida, and burned all of her correspondence with Hemingway because she didn't want that to be left after her death. But they maintained a friendship for the rest of Hemingway's life, at least.
Right. So there is no actual first-person narrative in the form of letters between Bump and Hemingway, but Marge was able to, you know, talk about this a little bit in some letters that she wrote to a bookseller who lived in New Hampshire. And those letters came into the possession of the Michigan Hemingway Society. And so that's what you're transcribing, isn't it, Jennifer?
Yes, it is.
Yael, what did you find in these letters of Marjorie Bump? Like, how did she talk about the way she'd been painted?
Well, in the letter that I transcribed, she was telling the bookseller how there was a Hemingway documentary on TV, and how they discussed how Hemingway painted a picture of his parents, and how she did not like the way that he described them, that they were not like that. She seemed quite frustrated. She even said in my letter that she wants to erase all of Hemingway after 1920. So I think it really depends which letters you look at. But in mine, for sure, she was not happy with the way that Hemingway was acting, and she described his personality as very know-it-all and not in a good light.
Mm. It's easy to imagine how unpleasant this was for Marge Yale, but did you find any evidence that her place in Hemingway's fiction actually affected the course of her own life?
Well, yes. It's quite apparent that it affected her own life. She moved from the small town of Petoskey to Florida, got married, her last name changed. She even said in one of her letters that she wanted to be a writer and she wanted to use her voice, but she felt like she couldn't because of this picture that was already painted of her in the Nick Adams stories. So these letters are a way for her to find her own voice even after her death.
Yael, would you say you consider yourself a Hemingway fan after knowing what you know now about all this?
Well, his writing is obviously very good. In terms of his personality and how he viewed women, it definitely made me change the way I thought of Hemingway. And that's why I think it's really important that we read these letters so that we have a different outlook on Hemingway and Marjorie Bump.
Yael Mizrahi is a sophomore at West Bloomfield. And we've also been talking with Jennifer Tynan. She's an English teacher and also secretary of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Jennifer, Yael, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for sharing a little bit about the project.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And that's the Stateside Podcast. I'm April Baer. You can find full episodes of Stateside streaming at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis, and today's episode was produced by Rachel Ishikawa. Our theme music is by 14KT, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.